Hi, welcome to the debate on the Euro. I'm Melissa Kite from The Times. They couldn't afford Peter Riddle, so I'm here instead. And despite the best efforts of public transport, I will be chairing the debate. As a journalist, I'm all too aware that the Euro is not something that gets perhaps the most impartial and in-depth analysis, and we hacks are not blameless in this. There's a lot of hysteria surrounding the arguments on both sides, which is probably why events like tonight are so important. We're also, of course, finally into the election, and the Euro, there's no doubt, is going to be a huge issue for the election, whether or not the government wants it to be. I've been doing a bit of research on the subject myself for a wee exclusive, so I hope you won't tell anyone about it. I've been ringing around Tory MPs and Labour MPs to see what they're going to say about the Euro in the coming weeks of the campaign. And Labour MPs are overwhelmingly telling me that they're not going to say anything at all. Tory MPs are going to say quite a lot, unsurprisingly. One aspect that of the issue that has emerged recently, and this is what Mr. Redwood is writing about in Stars and Strife, is the issue of whether we want to maintain and develop our links with the US, and whether our relationship with Europe is going to compromise this special relationship we have with America. So we hope Mr. Redwood will expand on his views on that. I'll introduce the panel we've got here tonight. Mr. Redwood needs no introduction, but I'll have a go anyway. He is the MP for Wokingham and a former Conservative Cabinet Minister. He now heads William Hague's Parliamentary Campaigns Unit. His views on Europe have livened up the Commons on many a dull afternoon, for us hacks especially. He's the author of many books on the economy, constitutional matters, Europe and the single currency. In his latest book, Stars and Strife, he looks ahead to the coming conflicts between the USA and Europe. He asks, should Britain become the 15th state of Euroland or the 51st state of America? And we're hoping to hear his answer tonight. Mark Leonard is widely credited with coming up with the phrase Cool Britannia. He's a former whiz kid with the new Labour think tank Demos. He has also been an unofficial advisor to Robin Cook as director of the Foreign Policy Centre, an independent consultancy that advises the Foreign Office and lists Mr. Cook as its president and Tony Blair as its patron. He is described as ambitiously Blairite. He was last month said to have been summoned by the Queen to give advice on how to make the royal family more trendy. Martin Holmes is co-chairman of the Bruges Group. He's an Oxford University don. He once said, on Europe, John Major blew it. As Neville Chamberlain is remembered as the Prime Minister of Munich, so will John Major be remembered as the Prime Minister of Maastricht. He also once predicted that New Labour would adopt Lady Thatcher's stance on the EC if they won the 97 election. Not sure about that one. Chris Huhne is Liberal Democrat MEP for the South East of England and a member of the European Parliament's Economic and Monetary Affairs Committee. He's a former business editor of The Independent. He believes the longer Britain delays during the Euro, the more we Britons will have been overcharged for cars, computers and mortgages. He also campaigned this year for the compulsory labelling of all ingredients in wine in the EU, something which can apparently make you feel a bit ropey, some of these things. So the EU can even take the pain out of hangovers. I think that's everyone, yeah? So I'm going to ask each member of the panel to outline their views, and we'll start with John Redwood.
Madam Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, it is my case tonight that Britain, as the fourth largest economy and one of the oldest democracies in the world, has a very good future as a global nation in her own right. It is my belief that we are better governing ourselves. We don't always agree with the people who govern us, but we have a system that can get rid of them from time to time, and from time to time we exercise that right and that choice. I see the euro as one important part of a much larger project. There is a project from our partners to create a United States of Europe. You won't believe myself or Martin telling you this, but you will, I'm sure, believe people like Chancellor Kohl, the former Chancellor of Germany, who made this crystal clear in his speeches, Chancellor Schroeder, the current Chancellor of Germany, who makes it equally clear that he wants a federal Europe organized upon German lines, where parts of Britain have as much independence as a German lander, and you can also see it in the speeches and actions of the senior politicians in the Republic of France. They mirror the views in many other of the European Union countries. That is why the European Union, which was sold to the British people as a common market, a way of improving our trade and our prosperity, has so much more. That is why it has a flag. That is why it has a parliament. That is why it has a Supreme Court that can now overturn acts made by the British Parliament, by your freely chosen and elected representatives, if it sees fit. That is why the European Union has an executive government called the Commission. That is why the European Union now wants to have an army, navy, and air force at its beck and call. That is why the European Union now wishes to have an independent foreign policy. That is why it is developing, or already has, an environment policy, a trade policy, a commerce policy, an industrial policy, an agricultural policy, a fishing policy. You name it, they've got a policy for it. You name it, they've already passed a law about it. You name it, there will be a directive on it. This is a very interventionist, all-embracing government which is in the making. Sometimes it's been done by stealth. It has nearly always been done by stealth by those Federalists in Britain who have held elected office, because they have always feared that the British people signed up to a common market and to friendly arrangements with our partners in Europe are not fully signed up, or indeed not signed up at all in most cases, to this notion of a much bigger superstate where we are but a set of important regions, very much controlled by the central bank, the central government, the executive commission, the Supreme Court, and all the other powerful bodies now emerging on the continent of Europe. So I do hope that those who conduct the debate from here in Britain will be more honest with us. I think they must tell us that, yes, this is the way the European Union is going, that the French and German leaderships are telling their electorates the truth about this, and that if Britain wishes to do something different, then Britain needs a Prime Minister which is going to argue very strongly that we need a different, a renegotiated arrangement with our partners that allows us to trade with them, to be friends with them, to be part of the common market which we joined, but does not take us down the road of joining their army, their navy, their air force, their foreign policy, their executive government, and subjecting all of our laws, or most of our laws, and many of our taxes to decisions by the Executive Commission and the Supreme Court, the European Court of Justice. Those who argue the case for the euro in Britain normally say that, of course, the euro is not part of this great plan, or that you could have the euro without any of the government that goes with it. Do not believe them. We're usually told that the main reason why we need the euro is it would be so much more convenient. Just imagine how easy it would be, they say, if you could turn up in Calais or Boulogne or somewhere and you had the same money as the French already have, and that you wouldn't have all those difficult transactions with bankers when you had to change your money over. Well, I've got news for those who argue that case, that a long time ago now, people invented just such a single currency. And the advantage of the single currency I use and probably you use when we go abroad is that it works in any country in the world, not just in the 12 ones that are going to join the euro. It's called a flexible friend or a plastic card. If you're cautious like myself, you have a debit card so that you don't end up borrowing money you haven't got. If you're less cautious, you have a credit card and you can then spend money you haven't got and rue the day later. But they do work very well, and I do recommend them as the cheaper solution to all those who think we need the euro to go shopping in a foreign land and to avoid the foreign currency problem. And for all those business people who say, wouldn't it be better if we had a common currency, a single currency with our partners, I say, haven't you heard about the world's single currency, or common currency rather than single currency, that of the United States dollar? I've got one with me, not that rich, you see, but I bring one as a prop. It is just one. It also has my favorite American president on, the one who always told the truth, Washington. If only we have politicians like that these days, they'd be held in so much more esteem. And there is the single dollar. There are many billions and trillions of those around the world. They are a very effective way of trading globally if you are an international company. I recommend it heartily. When I used to run an international company before I fell into bad ways in my current job, I found the dollar was the way to invoice and to carry out transactions, and then I brought them back into pounds when I thought it was the right time, when I needed to pay dividends and wages in United Kingdom sterling. One of the economic myths about the euro is that it creates stability. We're told that wouldn't it be so much easier for businessmen trading with other countries if they could guarantee that their currency wouldn't move around against those other currencies. But if we look at the history of the euro over the 2 years and a bit that it has been in existence, and remember it does exist now, you can have a bank account in it, you can invoice in it, you can trade in it, you can do anything with the euro, I'm told, other than have it in notes and coins. So for big business, they could use it if they wished. If you look at the history of the euro over the last 2 and a bit years, it has been far more volatile against the dollar, the yen, and the other major international trading currencies. So far from cutting our global risk, British companies, it would actually increase their global risk, because whilst it would clearly eliminate the currency risk into France or Germany, it would increase the risk into the Americas and into Asia. If you look at the pattern of our trade, that is very serious for a lot of our businesses, and indeed some businesses would have more currency risk rather than less if we had switched over to the euro when they wanted us to 2 and a bit years ago. The euro, of course, has not proved to be the knockout success that euro enthusiasts told us it would be when it was launched 2.25 years ago. We were told in the run-up to that momentous time that it would be a super strong currency and we should hurry to buy whilst stocks last. I'm pleased to say I didn't buy any, and I see that stocks lasted rather a long time and that it sunk like a stone for most of its life so far. Why did it sink? Well, it sunk because businesses on the continent, far from regarding the euro as a great step forward, decided to invest as much money as possible outside Euroland and were selling the predecessor currencies to the euro, and therefore the euro itself, in droves to make their investments in the United States of America or the United Kingdom or certain Asian currencies and countries. They wanted to get into dollars, into pounds, into yen. They didn't want to hold the euro, so it fell by about a quarter. Nor is it proving a knockout success with the publics in France or Germany, Italy or Spain. At the end of last year, the European Union and the banking system published some figures, and it showed that all the transactions in shops around Euroland are still almost overwhelmingly in national currencies. Although if you go in with your flexible friend or your checkbook, you can of course pay in euros rather than marks in Germany, or you can pay in euros rather than francs in France. Are they doing it? No, they're not. It is about 98.5% of all the transactions still being undertaken in francs, in Deutschmarks, in pesetas, in lira. So those who say the euro is a great idea and very popular have got an awful lot of work to do, because that isn't the view of all those people who are now given the choice. In a few months' time, they will have no choice at all. The currencies they prefer, the ones they're still using overwhelmingly, will be taken away from them. My case, though, is that the euro is just part of this much bigger issue. I do not think a country the size of Britain has to go in and share its government, its constitution, all its arrangements with a series of partners on the continent of Europe. Nor, I add, do I think we should become the 51st state of the American Union. We are distinctive. We have a different history. We once had a little disagreement with our former American colonies, but we seem to have got over that since then. But I do think we need to have a foreign policy fashioned in Britain, which means we can trade and be friends with France and Germany and Italy and Spain, and friends and trade and enter a common defense, as we've done since 1945, with the United States of America. One of the most worrying things in the world, if you are not on America's side, is that the gap between the capability and resources of the American military machine and that of any other nation is growing colossally. And I think in the next 5 years you're going to see an even bigger advance in American military capability, intelligence, computing,
ability to deliver weaponry if they need to do so, compared with all the other countries of the world put together. America is about to apply massive amounts of money and research and computer technology and communications technology to smart weaponry and to knowing exactly where potential hostile weapons are around the world. They are going to lift the fog of the battlefield, which has always predominated in previous conflicts and led to so much tragic loss of life and waste of men and materials. I think it would be especially foolish of the United Kingdom, given that in many respects we share common values and ideals with the United States of America, to choose this point when American ability is getting so much greater to distance ourselves from the United States and to put our defense lot more firmly in with a growingly independent European force of limited capability without the intelligence, the computing, and all the other things it needs to back it up properly. I am quite sure that it is NATO which has kept the peace in Europe and elsewhere since 1945. I think there is no need to mend it because it is not broken, and that at this juncture it is very important that the United Kingdom does a deal with the United States of America so that we have continued access to their intelligence and we can share their protective umbrella when it is in our mutual interest to do so. There is a big difference between NATO and the European Union. NATO cannot force you to do things against your will by legal action and court decision in the way the European Union can do. That, I think, makes it an easier and friendlier alliance. It is also a much more powerful alliance in defense terms. So my conclusion is that Britain should be independent. We have distinctive interests. We have friends and trading interests in the five continents of the world, and we should continue to pursue those interests wherever we wish. And we should make the decisions here. You, the British people, should decide who you want to make the decisions, and they should then offer leadership and make the appropriate decisions for our country. I want us to stay part of a single market arrangement, a trading arrangement with our European partners, and yes, I want us to enter some common rulemaking or lawmaking where we wish, but always preserving our right to say no if it doesn't suit our particular political complexion of the day. We need to get our vetoes back where they have been surrendered in dangerous ways, and we need to negotiate a better deal. I also strongly believe that we need a better free trade arrangement with the United States of America as well. If it works with Europe, why not with NAFTA? And I believe that we must do a deal soon with the United States over the next generation of intelligence, computers, and weaponry. Otherwise, we and Europe will fall hopelessly behind, and the NATO alliance, which has kept the peace, will be gravely damaged.
Thanks, John. You make it all sound so easy. Can I now ask Martin Holmes, co-chairman of the Bruges Group? Sorry. I was going to do the case against, but we'll go to Mark Leonard, who is Director of Foreign Policy Centre.
Thanks very much, Melissa. I'm going to try and answer the question whether Britain should become the 51st state of America or the 15th state of Euroland. But I agree very strongly with John Redwood that we shouldn't have to choose between Europe and America, and that the great advantage of our history and of our future is that we have got a strong relationship with both major and important allies. But where I do sort of disagree with John is on the two basic premises on which his entire argument was based, which I think are not only dishonest, they're disingenuous, and they're also a betrayal both of our history and of our future. First of all, the fact that Europe is part of some kind of project to become a super state. I don't really need to quote any better authorities than Prodi, the President of the European Commission, Joschka Fischer, the German Foreign Minister, Giuliano Amato, the Italian Prime Minister, all of whom have recently said that Europe is not going to become a super state, that they're as attached to their respective identities as we are to our identities, and that they see Europe as a way of cooperating together on shared problems and of benefiting from shared solutions to those problems. But the second sort of basic major argument is that Europe is somehow distinct from Britain, that we're not a European nation, that we don't have a European history. I think that's the single most dishonest and unhelpful element of the sceptic case, which has poisoned the debate about our national identity and our national interest and stopped us really engaging with what our destiny is. And what is presented as an economic argument, a military argument, an argument about our interests, is actually deep down under the eloquent words, the beautiful prose, essentially an inward-looking and xenophobic way of lying about history. And that's what I would really like to... To focus on. I'm going to leave the difficult factual analysis of what John was saying to my co-speaker. But I want to start with a quote from a famous British politician who said that we British are as much heirs to the legacy of European culture as any other nation. Our links to the rest of Europe, the continent of Europe, have been the dominant factor in our history. That was said not by Harold Macmillan or by Tony Blair or even by Sir Leon Britton, but they're the words of Margaret Thatcher to the College of Europe in her famous speech in 1988. And she was certainly right. British history cannot be understood in any other terms except those as the story of a European nation. And tonight I want to argue that historically, culturally, but above all by the inevitability of our geography, Britain has been formed by its close interaction with its European neighbours and not formed in some isolated Anglo-Saxon community which has fought tirelessly against the oppression either of a European bureaucracy or big government or funny foreigners or the other sort of arguments which are put forward. Secondly, I want to argue that this history has created a nation of peoples whose beliefs and attitudes have far more in common with our fellow Europeans than with the Americans. And that given Britain's essentially European identity, I would agree incredibly strongly with John that becoming the 51st state of America, even if it were an option, would actually cut us off from who we really are. And that's where the whole notion of our special relationship and what it really means and how far it can carry us really comes into question. So I'd like finally to just say a few words about that, to explain why it's important and absolutely essential to our future, why it is not really capable of taking us to the sort of places that John was talking about earlier. Throughout their history, the British Isles have really been islands in name only. As Thatcher went on to say in Bruges, for over four centuries we were part of the Roman Empire, which was a fairly diverse union of different ethnic groups with a common leadership, educational establishment, language, economic system, but where local identities flourished and were incredibly important. And even as European nation-states began to emerge in the 12th and 13th centuries, our affairs were inextricably linked to the European mainland with the spiritual leadership in Rome until the time of Henry VIII. From 1066 right up until the 16th century, the kings of England were also rulers of parts of France. English was not spoken at court until the 1300s. And we can carry on this history through the Reformation, through the arrival of Protestant Huguenots, the Dutch who came over and provided us with a new monarch. And this goes right up to the present royal family who come from Germany and who have provided us with many of our familiar German Christmas traditions. But this inextricable link to our continental neighbours didn't even end with the so-called splendid isolation of the 19th century when the empire was created. In fact, on the contrary, as Robert Skidelsky has very persuasively argued, the importance of Britain as a European power was never actually more dramatically illustrated than by our involvement in the two major European wars of this century. And in 1939, Hitler offered Britain a straight choice between falling back on the undisturbed enjoyment of a global empire or embarking on a European war in which defeat was a real possibility. It was quite simply the choice between the Commonwealth and Europe. And Britain chose the latter because it knew that at the end of the day, what happened in India, in Africa, or in any of the colonies would never be as important to British people as what might happen in Paris, Berlin, Prague, Moscow, or Rome. The cementing of these ties to our European allies in 1940 was a recommitment to the allies who've always held the key to ensuring the success of the British interest. It's worth remembering as John hinted at earlier on, that the only major war in which the British have fought in the last three centuries without significant continental European allies was also the only major war in which we were defeated, and that was the American War of Independence. So I think the lesson from that is that Britain can't really have hopes of a global role, of exploiting the links that John spoke about so passionately earlier, unless we're firmly rooted in Europe, we have a leading role in this continent, and we have a firm relationship with our allies. What is particularly bizarre is that many of the people who come from a Eurosceptic position, not John, as he made clear this evening, would actually go so far as to surrender British independence to a country which is over 3,000 miles away. And I think that all of the historical points I showed earlier on is that even at a time of the death of distance, when we have the internet and new technologies, geography does matter quite dramatically. But this really brings me to the second part of the talk, which is what does all this European history and geography mean for British identity today? And to begin with, I'd certainly not want to replace the kind of Europhobia which often gets trotted out in debates about these issues with an equally irrational phobia of the Americas. It's quite clear that America has been one of the greatest forces in the world for the promotion of peace, freedom, democracy. Its history is a unique example of a fusion of different identities coming together in a peaceful and progressive way. And I think that if Europeans can learn anything from America and from the American Constitution, it's not the need to try and parody this model with a federal structure, which I think only British Eurosceptics really believe in and actually support as a model, ironically. But it's the need to unify people behind a common dream, a vision of a future which can inspire successive generations, which is based on European values and on European hopes. And I think that vision for Europe is absolutely vital for us, because many people around Europe, including the British, are so acutely aware of the shortcomings of the American dream. First, it's clear that where the United States extols the pursuit of individualism and rampant consumerism, we know it's not enough. We want social cohesion as well as economic growth. And the price which is paid for untrammeled markets in the United States in terms of their healthcare system and other things is just too great a price for people in Europe to pay. For all its problems and the talk of crisis about British the health service, the transport system throughout the years, it remains the envy of the world, and it does mark us out as a peculiarly European country. But it's not just attitudes to welfare which make us similar to European partners and more similar to them than to the Americans. It's true of the sports we play, the food we eat, our attitudes to capital punishment, to gun control, to the need to preserve the environment. On all these issues, we periodically look across the Atlantic at our friends in incomprehension and occasionally in total disbelief. And it's not just that our tastes and values are different, it's the things that we're worried about. Now, I didn't share the pathological fear that some people have of genetically modified foods over here, but I was very much in a minority, and these things which caused such public outrage in the United Kingdom are consumed unquestionably in America. And at the same time, their fears, the things which really dominate the media, which get them going, to us often seem quite overblown, almost paranoid. The fears about China and rogue states don't really communicate that well to British people who, you know, have got an experience of years of British involvement in Hong Kong and probably have a slightly more relaxed attitude towards China. I also think that the American disregard for multilateral policies, which Europe has often embraced, seems to result in swings between apathy towards the rest of the world and paranoia, which we sometimes find quite difficult to understand. But the final thing I'd like to talk about as I run out of time is what this special relationship between Britain and America really needs. Because it's quite clear that we do have some very strong key features in common, particularly in terms of politics and law. And globalization has made us very familiar and largely appreciative of American popular culture. But those who have tried to locate British identity within an exclusive Anglo-American culture and history have massively overstretched the facts, both because France
And Spain and many other countries have got special links with the United States. They've drawn their political theory and their constitution from the French. The Spanish have incredibly powerful links with them. In a few years' time, there will be more people of Hispanic origin than of Anglo-Saxon origin in the United States, which blows up this extraordinary myth of an Anglo-Saxon club, which John Redwood was promoting in his book. But finally, because the United States have been the strongest advocates on the planet of European integration for the last 50 years, since Franklin D. Roosevelt. And if you look at the speeches of Colin Powell, of Condoleezza Rice, of the people around Bush, they're all unequivocally in favour of Europe getting its act together, of equipping itself so that they can deal, so that we can deal with our problems. Obviously not in conflict with NATO, but working together with NATO to keep the peace in Europe and beyond. And if every single American president since Franklin D. Roosevelt has had such a clear sense of the importance of European identity, the importance both for Europe as a continent and for us, and have seen us so much part of that thing, I think that we would be obviously betraying our future if we didn't wake up to that basic fact about who we are and where our interests lie. And part of that will also be waking up to what Europe really is, which is a network of independent states that work together towards common solutions and compete the rest of the time. And once we have that grown-up debate, then we will be able to really deal with the question of the euro and other things in a less sort of hysterical and emotional way. Thank you.
Thanks. Am I allowed to come to Martin Holmes now?
Madam Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, may I thank Palgrave and the London School of Economics for being such excellent hosts this evening in arranging this debate. I did prepare a 10-minute speech for this evening, but following the fascinating contribution that we've just heard from Mark, I've decided to disgorge it and to try to refute some of the fallacies to which we've just been subjected. And I have to say, with great regret, that I was very sorry indeed that Mark claimed that our case was xenophobic. I find this deeply insulting and distressing. It's an insult to me personally, which is false, to John and to all the Eurosceptics in this room. And I hope that when it comes to the questions, Mark will either provide chapter and verse and some facts. Let's have some quotes. Let's prove his case. Otherwise, I think he should retract, because I think it does a disservice to debate to use phrases of that kind. But it is something that I've come across over the last few years as I go around the UK debating Europe. So often, our Eurosceptic case is not challenged or rebutted, but we are simply accused of disliking foreigners. There is no justification for this argument. I personally like Europe. I like the peoples of Europe, the culture of Europe. I drive an Italian car. I drink Danish beer. I drink French wine. And thank goodness a Dutch midfield player helped to keep my team, Grimsby Town, from relegation. I'm off to Greece in a couple of weeks on my holidays. It's a nonsense to have a national debate when we are somehow labelled as xenophobic and opposed to Europe. Don't forget that across the continent of Europe, in France, nearly half the people voted no in the Maastricht referendum. The Danes voted against Maastricht and then were disgracefully forced to vote again. The Danes voted against the euro. The Germans would vote against it if Herr Fischer would give them a chance. Across Europe, there's been a growing Euroscepticism. This is from the continental countries. It's not just here in the UK. Mark, this is a development across the continent of Europe, because people realize that this is an elite project which lacks democratic legitimacy and which does not any longer have a real basis in the prosperity of the continent. So that's the first point I'd like to make in response to Mark's talk. Now, secondly, there's this question of a superstate. Now, Mark focused very cleverly on the word superstate. His whole argument in that section was based on that one word. But he knows what's happened over the last year or so because he knows all about Tony Blair's speech in Warsaw. Perhaps he wrote part of it. Because the phrase superstate is so unpopular, Tony Blair now calls it superpower. We're going to have a European superpower. That's the new buzzword, but a superpower and a superstate are the same thing. And if you look at the process of European federal integration, it is a process whereby power is transferred from the elected assemblies of the member states towards the institutions of the European Union. And this is what some leading supporters of integration have said about this process recently. Firstly, Romano Prodi. He said the single market was the theme of the 80s. The single currency was the theme of the 90s. We must now face the difficult task of moving towards a single economy, a single political unity. Now, how can you do that unless you castrate the national parliaments? Jacques Delors, in retirement, as active as ever and as ubiquitous. This is what he said in June last year. We will have to create an avant-garde. We could have a union for the enlarged Europe and a federation for the avant-garde. And in November last year, Joschka Fischer said, I believe that within a decade, that is before the end of this decade, we will be on the threshold of a European federation. Now, it doesn't matter what you call it, a superpower, a superstate, integrated, federation, supranational. The problem is that the member states are democratic, but the principal institutions that wield the power in the EU are not. And the transfer of power is away from the elected institutions to the unelected institutions. And this is our fundamental objection to this process. Now, thirdly, Mark gave us quite a long history lesson, starting with the Romans. Something of an intellectual hobby and sideline of my own. When the British leader was taken in chains to Rome, he said to them, what do you want with our mud huts? And what he meant by that was that he knew that back home there was massive collaboration because the Romans brought a civilization and a prosperity which the British in their mud huts could not by themselves provide. But the situation is different with the European Union. The European Union does not bring a superior prosperity. The UK economy has outperformed that on the continent in the last 20 years or so. The argument that because Britain was part of the Roman Empire, part of that cultural process, that we have to be part of a similar federation now is false. And significantly, what Mark left out of his history lesson was the left. And it's interesting that Mark and Chris, both men of the left, appear to have abandoned the historic tradition on the left. And that is a tradition of the radical tradition in British politics whereby the left seeks social advance through Parliament. This is a tradition that goes all the way back to the 17th century, to the Civil War, to the Levellers. It goes through the Glorious Revolution. It goes through Catholic emancipation, the repeal of the Combination Acts, which criminalised trade union activity. It goes through the whole process of religious toleration, the abolition of the Stamp Act, getting rid of slavery, votes for women. Now, this was a process all along the line that came about through Parliament. It came about through the sovereignty of Parliament. That doesn't say anything about the power of Britain. Don't confuse power with sovereignty. It's a process that was linked to our self-governance. And the Labour Party in the last century was the inheritor of that radical tradition. And it fought to lift many of the conditions of dire Victorian poverty that ground down the working class. And that's why so many people in the Labour Party courageously opposed our membership of the European community in the first place. And it's why brave people like David Stoddart, Peter Shaw, Austin Mitchell, Alan Simpson and others on the left still do the same. And the reason they oppose our incorporation into a European federation was not because they'd become xenophobes. It's because they valued freedom. If you accept the destination that Marx has mapped out for you, a supranational Europe, this is a political organization whereby the British people will lose that ability to advance their freedom in years to come. It is a complete betrayal of the radical tradition on the left in British politics. Now, I know how tempting it was in the 1990s, when the Labour Party had been in opposition all those years, to think that Europe was an ally, and that if we got rid of parliamentary sovereignty, you could get rid of the Tories. But there may be a terrible Elizabethan-style wheel of fortune, whereby, when you've got your supranational Europe, Mark, it may be Haider and the Italian National Alliance and the Vlaams Bloc. It may be parties of that kind that dominate, and you would then rue the day you threw away our parliamentary sovereignty. It would be a great betrayal. And concluding, Madam Chairman, just on the point of economics to which Mark referred. Yes, there was a period in which the UK economy was structurally converging with the continental economies. It was up to 1979. Now, like her or loathe her, the plain fact is that since 1979, our political economy has diverged because we have adopted the Anglo-Saxon model: free markets, free trade, deregulation, privatization, lower taxation, less government. In other words, we are conforming to and converging with the United States economic model. This is, for me, one of the most important reasons why economic integration with Europe does not suit the British economy and why we should never abandon the pound. Madam Chairman, I was in a European country last year. A country with 2% inflation, 5% economic growth, 2% unemployment only, full control of its own fishing limits, a prospering democracy. And if the 278,000 people of Iceland can do it, then we can do it with 58 million people. With a globalized economy able to take advantage of the new technology and a democracy worthy of the name.
Yeah. Thanks. We'll come back to Mark Leonard at the end and see if he wants to retract his comments. But first of all, we want to hear from Chris Hume, MEP.
Thank you, Chairman. I'm sorry to perhaps lower the tone a bit with them after Martin's speech, but I'm particularly pleased to be here since I know Martin confessed to me on the way in that there was a three-line whip here tonight for the Bruges Group, and I'd particularly like to welcome some of my favourite hecklers to you, sir, who keep this marvellous old Anglo-Saxon word balderdash in continued use. I salute you, and I renew my offer of many, many meetings that we should really share our travel expenses, because words save a lot. But well, I have an awful feeling you may be right on that. I suspect that you do go to more than I do. But I want to address what I think is the absolutely fundamental core of John's argument. And that appears on page 21 of his new book. And he says, all this argues in favour of having friendly commercial links with our partners in Europe, but not joining them in their project to create a large, expensive, protective superstate. Now, if I actually thought that our partners in Europe were involved in that project to create a large, expensive, protective superstate, I suspect I would be lining up on John's side of this argument. Let me develop the argument a bit, and you come back in questions if you think I'm not giving you sufficient substantiation. But it seems to me, looking at this whole argument, that the parallel I'm afraid that I would draw with John is that with Don Quixote, seeing far off in the distance not a harmless, useful windmill, but in fact some dragon threatening us with all manner of terrible consequences. In reality, what we see in Brussels really is a windmill, and it is not a dragon. You can, let me give you three facts. You can measure the importance of a level of government in three separate ways. You can look at what it spends in public spending terms. You can look at the number of people it employs. You can look at its legislative activity. I can't think of other ways, but perhaps you'll be able to. So let's examine Brussels, all of the European institutions, taking those three tests against the member states. If you look at public spending, the amount of public spending that goes through the European institutions is currently 1.11% of GDP in the European Union, and by the way, it's going down. It's not going up, unlike many national governments. The total level of public spending for all levels of government within the EU is 45% of GDP. So basically, we're spending 45 pence in the pound on all levels of government, and precisely one penny in the pound goes through Brussels. So it doesn't look to me as if that is a super state in the making if you take that criterion. So let's take the next criterion. Let's look at the number of employees of the Brussels institutions. If you take all of the employees, including all those involved in this very important process of deferring to different national identities through translation and through interpretation, you actually find that there are 23,000 people on the payroll of all of the Brussels institutions. That compares with the current payroll of Birmingham City Council of 50,828. You're perfectly able to make that argument, sir. I will begin by going on in a minute to explain exactly what useful things these 23,000 people do. But let me please at least make my point, which is to put it in the perspective of the overall level of government. Britain employs 460,000 civil servants, public servants, involved in government. So put it in that context, 23,000 against 460,000. Now, let me take the third test. I mean, please, I know perfectly well that you will have arguments against this, but it's important to establish some basis of fact if we're going to try and understand what's really going on. My third point, and the third criterion for comparing government, is legislative activity. Now, there was a very important increase in EU legislative activity at the end of the 1980s, after the passing of the Single European Act, and Mrs. Thatcher was quite right, in my view, to ensure that that happened, because it's what actually established a real single market within the EU. If we were still in a position where we basically had free trade, but we didn't have common standards for consumer safety, common standards which actually enabled us to sell throughout the European Union, rather than have other member states blocking entry of British goods, then Mrs. Thatcher realized, and she was quite right to realize, that the single market would be meaningless. So there was an increase in legislative activity at EU level to establish that common basis at the end of the 1980s. I was very interested to discover, when I actually asked a parliamentary question as to the current stock of legislation, of directives and regulations, and I asked for this at the end of every year for the last 10 years, to discover that in fact there has been no increase over the last 10 years. There was an increase at the end of the 80s, but since the beginning of the 1990s, we've actually been repealing as much legislation at European level as we've been putting on the statute book. Now, not all of that legislation I approve of, I'm sure not all of that legislation you approve of. But let's please put this debate about a growing European superstate in the context of some facts rather than emotional hyperbole. Now, if you actually look at what this legislation does, it seems to me overwhelmingly, and there are mistakes, I freely confess, as there are at national level, but overwhelmingly it is trying to establish some public choice over things which are often outside the control of individual countries. Take the obvious example, cross-border environmental effects such as acid rain. If we pass legislation in the UK which limits the emissions from power stations in the UK, we benefit Scandinavia. If we want to get the benefit of not having sulfur dioxide emissions dropping on us in the form of acid rain, we need that legislation passed in France and Spain. It makes sense if you are in such geographical proximity to other European countries sharing cross-border problems, such as those on the environment, such as those, as Mrs. Thatcher saw, in the case of establishing the single market, that you have an ongoing process to do that. Now, to my mind, the euro is another example of that. It's an example, first of all, of creating the single market, of ending rip-off Britain, and we pay more for not just cars, but Coca-Cola, for branded goods like Levi's and Chanel No. 5, over and over again. We've seen it in the multinationals themselves call this country Treasure Island, precisely because of their ability to gouge consumers in this country with higher prices than other Europeans are prepared to pay. And the euro is ending that phenomenon on the continent. It's actually aligning prices on the continent. The big multinationals are having to charge the same price everywhere, and that's the price which is coming down to competitive level. So it's a real potential benefit for us in this country in boosting our prosperity. A second very important gain of the euro, which is very much a gain in the context of extending public choice, is this question of establishing some sort of economic environment which gives our traders stability. If you look at the post-war history of sterling, the one word which you would associate with sterling is surely crisis. Sterling and crisis go together like marmalade and toast. The reality is, if we want to have a clear, stable environment in which, for example, Nigel Lawson, when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer, was not forced to raise interest rates inappropriately for domestic economic conditions by the fact that international capital flows were pushing the pound down to nearly $1, as was the case in the mid-1980s. If we want to avoid that sort of problem, or indeed the opposite problem that we have today, of an overvalued exchange rate, pricing 350,000 people out of jobs in manufacturing over the last 3 years, if we want to establish that sort of stability, we need to use the euro. I want to finish on one point about whether or not John's argument on this expansive superstate can be saved by the view that the euro itself will help to create it. And I don't see that at all. I see no necessary connection between big government at any level and a monetary union. And we know that from our own history. Because Ireland, after it got its independence from the United Kingdom in 1921, was actually in a monetary union with this country throughout the period till 1979. Every time British interest rates moved, Irish interest rates moved. Every time the pound moved against the dollar, the Irish pound moved against the dollar. They were in complete monetary union with this country. And over that period, they not only moved from dominion status to a complete republic, they actually maintained their neutrality during a war in which we were fighting for our lives and our liberties. They exerted an extraordinary degree of national sovereignty without any political superstructure whatsoever. I can give many other examples. Belgium and Luxembourg would be another one. There is absolutely no necessary connection between a monetary union and a political superstructure. Now, I personally believe it is necessary to have some overarching rules to make the system work better than it would do otherwise. But I am absolutely convinced that we can deliver a functioning euro membership in this country without going beyond the existing absolute treaty limit on public spending at a European level of 1.27% of GDP. And I'm absolutely convinced, too, that we can establish the euro successfully without going beyond what is clearly written down in the treaties. And it's not ideal. It's certainly not everything that I would necessarily support. But overall, it seems to me that it's a real benefit for this country. Now, I have left out one issue, because John says their project to create a large, expensive, protective superstate. Well, it isn't large. We've established that It isn't expensive. We've established that. You may think it isn't value for money, but it certainly is not a very large, significant part of public spending. And I would simply give one piece of evidence on whether it is protective, because that's not my experience. I mean, in a former role as a journalist, I was Brussels correspondent of The Economist, covering the Tokyo round of trade negotiations, and we've had round after round of trade negotiations in the post-war period which have reduced tariffs and introduced new means of reducing non-tariff barriers. Currently, the weighted average tariff for the EU is 3.87%, and the weighted average for the US is 3.43%. Now, I don't think we're going to come to blows over 0.4% on a weighted average tariff. Overall, we are moving towards free trade. I want to get there faster. I would actually like to have an Atlantic free trade area between the EU and the United States, but I am absolutely convinced that we will get there much faster by being within the EU and arguing for it than we ever will if we're outside the EU and in a much less influential position to do so. So I would say, just to sum up, that's the core of John's case, and it's wrong. It is not a dragon. There be no dragons in Brussels. It really is a windmill.
Okay, I want to throw it open to the floor and get as much from you as possible. Just quickly, can I just, I mean, Mark, Leonard, you've been accused of being xenophobic, and are you going to retract your comments? I mean, is there anything there that you that you feel that you should?
I was being, because of the format of the evening, I was trying to get some debate going. I'm not trying to say that all Eurosceptics are xenophobic, but I am. I do think that John Townend and various other members of the Eurosceptic tendency have shown that some Eurosceptics are. And that some of the arguments which are put across are arguments which are about our national identity and which misrepresent our national identity and try and set up a false barrier between Britishness and our European identity.
Okay, well, we'll throw this open in a minute, but we've got to say goodbye to Mr. Redwood, who has another appointment on question time, so we'd just like to thank him for being here.
Madam Chairman, can I thank you all very much for coming? This event was arranged a long time ago when we thought it would be post-election. It hasn't quite worked out like that, and I've now been asked to do my duty on question time. I'm very sorry I have to go. I wish you a very successful evening, and I know Martin will be a marvellous advocate of our views. Thank you.
Thanks. I'm going to throw it open to the floor. Can as many people as possible come in, please? It's the lady in the front, please. Well, if you direct it to this part of the room.
Thank you. I'm not from Europe, and I'm not from the United States of America. But I understand that talking what he talked, not from a very belly-button, provincial, or selfish point of view, but taking ethics and ethical framework, whatever has been done progressively in this country as far as environment, human rights, humanitarian intervention, real humanitarian intervention, not disguised one. Development rate, whatever, is coming from inspiration from Europe and not from the United States. So he kept insisting on national interests and security issues. So as far as stability is concerned, I think the kind of security that Europe can reflect and debate about is far more secure than the current stance of the United States of America with its failed policy towards Iraq, all these scandals on depleted uranium, and everything that Britain is doing very disgracefully in the field of security. I have lots of criticism. So my question for him was to redress the whole of his speech from an ethical point of view.
I don't think I've quite got time for that.
I have one question for him. That he mentioned the parliament, I mean, that we're jeopardizing Britain's parliament, and that the European project was an elite thing. I think Parliament in Britain is losing a lot of its reputation lately as far as values after this anti-terrorist act and all these asylum seekers thing. So I think if you're going to support British Parliament, we better, you know, really, really take care of this Parliament.
Okay.
And it's not going to come from the United States of America, example for sure. Thank you.
Do you want to come back?
No, I think if John was here, he would very much agree with those sentiments, because that is an indictment of the foreign policy of the Blair administration. On the one hand, preaching an ethical foreign policy, and then they're involved in acts of war, which in the Kosovo conflict led to the loss of civilian lives, especially the civilians killed on the bridge just inside Serbia, the poor journalists that were killed in the attack on the television station, the bombing of the bridges in Novi Sad and in Vojvodina, the attack on the Chinese embassy. All of these, I think, are examples of a divergence between the ethical statements of the Blair administration and the way in which that war was pursued. I personally thought that it was not in Britain's national interest to be involved in that war in Yugoslavia, and I thought that the way in which those civilian deaths were blamed by Robin Cook on Milosevic would be an equivalent of, for instance, Hitler blaming Churchill for the bombing of Coventry. And surely if you bomb, you are responsible. The bombing of Vietnam was the responsibility of the Americans. The bombing in Afghanistan of the Soviets. The destruction in Prague of the Soviets. The bombing of Guernica of the Axis powers. And equally, the bombing and death unnecessarily of those civilians in Yugoslavia was the responsibility of the Allied coalition, the most enthusiastic members of which were the UK. So I agree with you. I think there is a very serious indictment here against the UK government for the way it performed in 1999. And as far as the legislation of the British Parliament is concerned, yes, sometimes they get it right and sometimes they get it wrong. But at least when they get it wrong, we can throw the blighters out. We have control over our own destiny, which we lose if we hand it over to Europe.
Okay, thanks. Can we take some more views? Gentleman behind.
Could I possibly just come in on
Can we just take one more question and we'll come back?
I'm sorry that John Redwood left, because I wanted to congratulate him really on raising in the book the fundamental question that faces the British public and the at the moment, which is our relationship between the United States and Europe. This is a fundamental question. It's good to see it being raised. But John's stance was basically one that international theorists described as bandwagoning, riding on the bandwagon of the United States, clinging to its coattails, doing whatever the Americans would like us to do, which has been since 1956 in Suez. Now, that may have made sense during the Cold War, when there was a worldwide conflict between the capitalist world and the Soviet world. But we're no longer living in a world dominated by a bipolar conflict, where it made sense to line up with, for all its fault, a country that, you know, we could feel more comfortable with than with the Soviets. But does that any longer apply in a world of a single hyperpower? In the French phrase, surely in the world, you know, in a world which is dominated by a single hyperpower, the traditions of British foreign policy are, in fact, to seek to balance that hyperpower.
Okay,
could I just finish the
just
point? And the only power in the world potentially capable of balancing the United States hyperpower is the European Union.
Okay, Christian.
Well, just briefly say on that, I think your question implies that there is a sort of balance of power view of the world, and that is one that we can still apply. I mean, I think that clearly worked for a lot of European history. I think that we have had another approach to dealing with this sort of problem more recently, which is to attempt to establish a rule of law internationally so that the worst episodes of one state attempting to exert power over others have actually been limited. And indeed, that's been very much a fundamental part of the EU project. It is essentially, the EU is a system for reconciling differences between European states, which
can you keep it fairly brief,
were extremely, extremely
people want to.
But I wanted, if I may, Chairman, to mention the point the previous questioner made about the UK Parliament, because I very much agree that it is actually crucial that the House of Commons should be more actively involved in monitoring what ministers do in the Council of Ministers. I think it is a complete outrage that the Council of Ministers, which is the most important EU institution, it is where each member state sends one minister and each member state is equally represented. That institution, first of all, meets in secret, which is the only legislature I know of other outside Cuba and North Korea which does so. And that suits, I'm afraid, national ministers very well, because they can then spin whatever story they want to their national presses. But secondly, it means, it contributes to the fact that the national parliaments do not hold ministers to account when they actually take decisions in the Council of Ministers, except the honourable exception of the Danish Folketing, which does actually haul ministers before the relevant committee. But the House of Commons' record on holding British ministers to account is frankly appalling, not just on the government side, but also on the opposition side.
Okay, well, we don't
side.
Want to get into that, because that's another...
Let me give you one final point, which is the British MPs last year asked only 79 questions in the House of Commons about the work of the European Union out of a total of 41,000 parliamentary questions that were tabled.
Okay,
that's how important
I want to get some
the
more
House
questions
of Commons
in.
Regards our ministers' job at the Council.
Lady in the middle here, please. In the pink shirt. She's had her hand up. Here. Oh, sorry.
Thank you. I feel I need to say this brief bit first. I'm not a Tory, and I've never been near the Bruges group, and I'm definitely not any easy kind of alliance with the speakers on that side. In fact, I've been Liberal and Liberal Democrat for the last 30 years. But I, before the third speaker spoke, said I actually did find your accusation of xenophobia somewhat disgraceful.
Sorry, I didn't actually make an accusation of xenophobia.
No, not you. No, Mark Leonard. I beg your pardon. Of course you didn't, no. I assume that not too many people here needed that long history lesson, and indeed, of course, all the countries of Europe have been in their history and culture inextricably intertwined for the last 1,000 years or so, but I wonder you can't perhaps really have it both ways. We have been intertwined, we are, and I for one am English and I'm definitely a European. You don't really give me an argument for saying why I need anything else. I am a European, I have been our forebears have been for over 1,000 years. You perhaps should have said why we need anything extra, such as the euro.
Can we keep it to the brief?
Can I just say, I hope that... I'll miss that one out. I'm also passionately keen on democracy. You know, I vote Liberal Democrat. So I would like to hear an argument for further joining in a non-democratic Europe before it's reformed rather than after.
Okay, let's just go to Mark Leonard. I mean, you've had a lot of accusations here over this term xenophobia. Are you still happy with that?
I want to clarify, I wasn't accusing anybody in this room of being xenophobic. What I said is that sometimes arguments... What I was saying, which I do think is true, that sometimes arguments made against our participation in Europe are motivated by those sorts of considerations, as well as other considerations. And that is what often means that we don't have a very clear debate about these issues, because it's passion and heat and light rather than rational
facts. Is there anyone here?
Can I answer the point about democracy? Because I think that is absolutely critical. And I think I totally share everything that the questioner said about a European identity. And that's not something which needs to change. But what does need to change is for us in a global world to develop solutions to problems which cut across frontiers. And that's what Chris, I thought, argued very, very convincingly when he was talking about the environment. But the environment's just one set of issues. There's international crime and drugs and all sorts of other issues which we can't deal with on our own. And we do have a democratically elected House of Commons, but when they come together and make decisions, they can't deal with things which cut across borders. So the choice is not between having a democratic House of Commons and having which can solve all our problems, and an undemocratic Europe, which it's actually a choice between a democratic House of Commons, which doesn't solve things, and a democratic Europe, which can solve things. We need to make Europe work more effectively.
Anyone
rather
want to
than
come back
being
at,
so
at
defensive.
Mark in particular, the gentleman at the back?
Yeah, when you talk about democracy, the economist that Chris Ewing used to work for, the economist has just said that Signor Berlusconi, who's about to win the Italian election, isn't fit to run a democratic country. Chancellor Kohl has just paid a £100,000 fine rather than go to jail. We've seen President Chirac being told last week that he's now under official investigation for corruption. We have seen Ronald Dumas, the former French foreign minister, on trial for corruption. We've seen Giulio Andreotti, the former Italian prime minister, on trial for being head of the mafia and trying to murder a journalist. We've seen two French prime ministers, one commit suicide because of corruption, the other one stand trial because of manslaughter. We could go on and on. The Spanish prime minister resigning for running death squads, the vice prime minister of Belgium having to resign as secretary general of NATO because of corruption. Do you think this is a coincidence?
Okay, can we just go to the gentleman here?
Can I possibly...
Just one second, I want to get some more views.
Sorry, I'm from Australia.
You're not going to get answers. I mean, we've had two quite substantial questions. I haven't been able to pick up the points, both on democracy and on corruption.
Well, we've got to wind up quite soon. That's a lot of hands up.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm from Australia.
I would like to. I'm afraid I'm not given the opportunity.
So I'm from Australia, and I find the debate that I see here very poor. What also concerns me as somebody who's actually held political office in Australia is there does seem to be a bit of sort of a feeling of this meeting being somewhat stacked. And whilst I appreciated one gentleman who actually did give me some facts and figures, I don't like to be in on a meeting that I know has perhaps been stacked. Now, I've never attended any of these meetings before, so I would just like to ask what percentage of the people here today are people who have a definite view one way and seem to sort of go from meeting to meeting, because I don't like attending those.
We'll have a show of hands at the end. Christian, you wanted to come back.
Can I come back on two points? I think, first of all, on the question of a democratic Europe, which the lady raised and which I think is absolutely crucial, and I gave one very important reform, I think, which we should have, which is opening up the Council of Ministers to make sure that it is actually available to television cameras and journalists, and you can see what your legislator in the shape of a national minister is actually doing. Now, it seems to me that, in fact, the process of passing legislation is pretty democratic. You may not approve of us in the European Parliament, and we clearly have a big problem in the UK because the turnout was half of what it was in the European average for the European Parliament, but the European Parliament is democratically elected, and it does deliberate on legislation, and 80% of EU legislation cannot be passed now without the affirmative assent of the European Parliament. The Council of Ministers is representative of all our nation states. A minister goes there. The fact that we are so feeble in the House of Commons not to hold our ministers to account seems to me an ongoing scandal, which is more to do with the constitutional problems that we have in this country than it is to do with the EU. So don't get the impression that the EU is undemocratic. It can be improved without any doubt at all.
Okay, we spent time on the EU, but I want to get some specific votes.
And let me make one point on corruption, because I do think it's important. We've actually had quite a lot of instances of corruption in this country as well, and power does tend to attract it. The important thing is to make sure it's coming out. The great thing, I sit in the European Parliament with Antonio Di Pietro, who actually began the campaign in Italy, the so-called Clean Hands campaign, and who actually brought this all out in the open. And that is the sign that it is being put
okay,
right.
I'm going to have to stop you because we've had lots of views on the European Parliament, nothing on the euro. Does anyone want to talk about the euro? This gentleman.
I believe that the euro is not a political or economic issue, it is a constitutional issue. And I would very much like to hear Dr. Holmes's views on that particular and quite specific issue. Thank you.
Martin Holmes.
Yes, I think this is a very important question indeed, and I was interested in what Christopher Huhne had to say about the euro. He strongly advocates it. But the problem I have with Chris's analysis of the euro now is that it appears to be so similar to Chris's analysis of why we should join the ERM in the late 1980s, what a good job the ERM was doing, and even when we left it, why we should rejoin it. Writing in The Guardian on the 30th of November 1988, Chris said, quote, joining the European monetary system would be an insurance against a sterling crisis. Well, what on earth happened in September 1992? This is what created the crisis.
Now, come on.
Because what he regards as stability is in fact a rigidity.
Can I please make the point that you will find another quote from when I was writing in The Independent 6 months before the crisis, saying that we had joined at the wrong time, at the wrong rate, and that the ERM was actually going to suffer a problem. Now, if you are unable to change your views to reflect circumstances and reality, that is your problem. When reality changes, I change my views.
Can I just get one more speaker? There's a lot of noise coming from this sort of direction. Does anyone want to actually stand up and make a point?
But it's still true.
Yeah.
Yes, the gentleman on the right has just said that he revised his views on the ERM, for example. Of course, if we join the euro, we will never ever be able to change the rate at which sterling effectively trades against what used to be the currencies of our continental partners. We will always be locked into, at the moment, a rate seriously north of 3 DM against 10.5 to French francs. That's what the rate is today.
Whatever the rate is that you choose,
you guys always want to come along later and say, oh, of course, but the mistake was we shouldn't have gone at that
it's
rate.
It's not true.
The whole point about the argument on the euro and sterling, from the economic point of view, is that there is no one rate which is right for all time. There might be a rate overnight, one night. There may be a rate for a month or two. But things are moving so rapidly in these areas, there's never going to be a rate which is stable over
any
significant period.
We know perfectly well that the rate at which we joined the ERM was very high because the government actually spent the previous year bidding it up in order to try and control inflation. The reality is we should not join at the current rate, and there would be no question of us joining the euro at the current exchange rate because the finance ministers actually have said that the euro is overvalued and that is undervalued, and that includes, obviously, against sterling. In fact, I chaired a commission for the party last year, and the rate range which we came out with had a top end of 284 in Deutschmark terms or 145 in euro terms, and that would be the rate which we should aim at, and I think there would be no difficulty in ensuring that that happened because our partners on the continent are as aware as we are of the overvaluation of sterling which we're suffering currently.
Can we just have Martin back?
Yeah, Chris, I just want to have one more quotation because you interrupted me earlier, and I saw you do that on television with Theresa Villiers, and it worked with her, but it won't work with me. And in relation to the question a moment ago, why did you want us to rejoin the ERM in September 1992 when you wrote this in The Independent? It would be wrong to insist on a long list of preconditions before rejoining the ERM at a lower rate.
Sorry, at a what rate?
At a lower rate.
Right.
It is in our own interest to do so, not least because of the difficulty of withstanding political pressure to cut interest rates and let the pound slide too enthusiastically. In a nation of debtors, there is little more popular than a burst of inflation to erode debt and push up money income.
Okay, just very
Why
quickly.
Did you write that in September 1992, and was that right or wrong?
That sounds to me to be a perfectly reasonable analysis. We do not want to see a very volatile exchange rate. And I think that over time, frankly, with the sort of bans that we currently have for the exchange rate mechanism, I don't see any of the sort of problems in steering sterling within that. And that has been a long-standing tradition. As you probably remember, under the Bretton Woods system, the pound was actually completely stable from a period immediately after the war up until 1971, with the exception of the devaluation in 48 and the devaluation in 67. And if you go into a system like that, where you're attempting to provide some sort of environmental certainty for your business, it strikes me as perfectly reasonable.
Okay, we've gone well over the time, but just on the euro. Is it on the euro?
No, not on the euro.
Well, this debate is on the euro, so if anyone's got anything to say. this gentleman.
No, it's just to make the point that we are here to talk about the euro, and Britain is a global trader. I spent my life in exporting, and I've worked in 50 to 60 countries and dealt in almost as many currencies. The idea that by joining the euro will aid British exports and business is a fallacy. I've never had any problem in dealing in dirhams or whatever currency, and I can protect myself against fluctuations of currency. So I think that's a red herring, that we have to join the euro to advantage British industry and exports.
Well, you have already. Okay. I apologise, but we have had a lot of comments about that issue and very little on the single currency.
Let us be clear about one thing. Xenophobia
The labelling of Eurosceptics as xenophobic is a quite deliberate, consistent ploy by Europhiles. It occurs in almost every Europhile meeting that I go to. It is not an accident that you said it. It is deliberate, and it is a means of labelling those of us who believe in self-government and democracy as wild-eyed lunatics. I object to it most vehemently. I believe in democracy. I believe in the democracy of this country, the right under Magna Carta, the Bill of Rights, and 800 years of common law in a parliamentary democracy to be ruled by people whom I elect and whom I can remove. To believe in that is not xenophobia.
Okay.
Coming now to Mr. Hoon. Mr. Hoon's treatment of economics reminds me of that of my pensions advisor, but the difference is that I could take him to court, and against you I would have no redress. My question for Mr. Hoon is this. I have never been able to understand why a liberal democrat would ever want to be in an European Union which is neither liberal nor democratic. Would you please explain to me under what authority, by what right, the constitution of this country and the rights that we were born with, that we built up over 800 years and our ancestors kept for us, how and by on what authority those rights have been given away so that we now find ourselves ruled by people debating in closed rooms, speaking in foreign languages, as a Welshman who doesn't speak Welsh.
I think I'm going to have to ask Mark Leonard to come back on that.
I was about to apologise to everyone for having raised the whole issue of xenophobia, because so many people had risen to tell me how mistaken I was, and I was very relieved to see an open-minded and internationalist community.
We all know the politicians tell lies. We need to be able to understand what they are saying to know what the lies they're telling us.
I think everyone else in the... But can I just make a substantive point? I share your passionate belief in democracy and the Magna Carta and all those things. And that's why I get so angry when people try and misrepresent the European Union as a body which we have given our rights away to. First of all, the European Union is not them. It's not some kind of weird institution over there of people imposing laws on us. It's our ministers going to Brussels, negotiating with other ministers on common problems, voting things through, and they don't feel threatened or undermined or dictated to by other people. They know that they're setting the agenda as much as anyone else is. And then it's democratically elected people like Chris and his colleagues scrutinising the directives that get passed, And our House of Commons holding, or not holding, sometimes, as Chris pointed out earlier, our democratically elected ministers to account for the decisions which they make on our behalf. That is not undemocratic. It's not handing powers over to other people. It's cooperating on shared problems. And almost all of the basic areas which are, in fact, all the basic areas which are fundamental to our national identity are things which have to be decided by unanimity, and we can block them and veto them if we want to.
Okay,
it's strange that no other country in the European Union actually feels threatened by that. They feel that their identity as independent sovereign nation states is enhanced by being able to work with others.
Okay,
and I think we should do that as well. But as a passionate Democrat, I think we can actually move a lot further and make things better, make the institutions work better as well.
But I want to get a show of hands. Is there anyone who would want to withdraw from the European Union? Can we have a show of hands now?
Yes, certainly.
I think that explains a lot. there's probably no... Probably no point asking. Can we have a show of hands? If there was a referendum tomorrow, who would vote for a single currency?
You've lost.
A referendum for the single currency, would you vote for? Against? Well, that one's fairly even. We've run out of time, I'm sorry. The views are far too different to get any further, but thanks very much, and thanks to our panel.